I'm going to do something different for the sermon today. We'll see how it goes. Normally my messages are very structured and very clear intro and SPS and such and very well organized. Today's sermon is going to be a little bit different, so hopefully you'll find it helpful and relevant. But I'd like to walk through history from the perspective of God working in and through various temples. So it's going to be a message both combined with some history. We're going to look at a number of prophecies as well and how those tie into history and what we know from history books and such. But it's also going to tie in with our study this month on the book of Haggai. For those here in Tulsa, we had a Bible study before services in Kansas. We'll do it this next week. But this study will hopefully give some background and some other context and information relating to our study with the book of Haggai and things that God has done with his people and for his people down through time. I have a handout that I'll make available back here on the table after services. For those in Kansas, I'll bring your copy on Monday and Tuesday of this next week when I'm up there. The handout is 6 pages, and you can take it home and read through it and study. It's loaded with scriptures, and I would encourage you to try to find additional scriptures to add to the handout. But I'd like to do the sermon today on kind of this historical walk through the temples that God has lived in, the temples that God has dwelt in, and a lot of the history and prophecies surrounding those temples. So let's start straight away with King David. If you go with me over to the book of 2 Samuel. It's for 2 Samuel chapter 7. David, of course, was described as a man after God's own heart. We know that he wasn't flawless, that he had sins and things that he committed. He was not perfect in all points from that perspective, but he loved his God. He helped the nation of Israel to keep God's commands. He was a very righteous king, a king that God viewed very positively. We know at some point David decided that he wanted to build God a house, a temple. Notice 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 1. It came to pass when the king was dwelling in his house and the Lord had given him rest from his enemies all around, that the king said to Nathan, David said to Nathan the prophet, "See, now I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells inside a tent curtain." I'm in this big, beautiful palace made of expensive everything, and God here is dwelling out there inside a tent. For those that have been through the book of Haggai, it kind of is reminiscent a little bit about what some of the statements there in Haggai. Of course, that was on the opposite side. God was chastising them for saying, "You live in these nice places, and yet I, you know, my house is in ruins." Here we see the positive flip around version of that. David is acknowledging it and saying, "I live in this great place. God is out dwelling in a tent. I want to fix this. I want to help reconcile this." Through Nathan the prophet, in the following verses, God essentially tells David that his militaristic ways and some of the things he has done, it does not qualify him for that particular project, but God would take that project up through his son Solomon. And so Solomon would end up completing the project. During the balance of David's life, though, he acquired much wealth. He laid up a lot of materials for his son, gold and silver and fine linen, and lined up workers and craftsmen and things in order to construct this temple. Let's go to the book of 1 Chronicles. There's an interesting verse that is buried here that I think is profound. We oftentimes think of the temple, this first temple, Solomon's temple, from the perspective of all the grandeur that went into it, the fine woods, the fine metals, the detail of some of the engravings and such. But do you ever think about the land that it was built on? Have you ever considered the land? Let's notice here, 1 Chronicles chapter 21. The entire chapter here is interesting from this perspective. You can read it later, but I want to just jump right in and grab one specific verse. And you can read 1 Chronicles 21 on your own. Let's read 1 Chronicles 21 verse 18. The angel of the Lord commanded God to say to David that David should go and erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. So we see this very specific reference to a piece of ground that God wanted the altar built on. When you go this next week and study the rest of 1 Chronicles chapter 21, there was a contract that was made. There was a purchase agreement, you might say, that was drawn up. Money was exchanged for this threshing floor of Ornan. We oftentimes will think of the building, but we don't oftentimes think of even David making preparations to buy the land that Solomon's temple would be built on. And so chapter 21 here, 1 Chronicles, details that whole story. God tells David, that's the land that I want. That's the place I want. And then David goes off and begins negotiations with Ornan and purchases the property. You'll read through chapter 21 that Ornan wanted to sell it at a discount. David said, no, this is for God. We're not going to negotiate any sort of discount. You tell me what the land is worth, I will pay full price for it. And so I think this is an interesting side note with the preparations that David made. It wasn't just the lumber, it just wasn't the gold, the silver, the fine linens, the craftsmen and all of that. He also went and purchased the very specific piece of property that God wanted his altar built on. This area, this threshing floor of Ornan, is also referred to as Mount Moriah. It's considered to be the same site that Abram brought Isaac to. You'll recall that story of Abram bringing Isaac, his son, up for a sacrifice. And anyway, I'm sure you recall that particular story. This is believed to be the same site, Mount Moriah. The threshing floor of Ornan, it's the same piece. It's the same piece of land. David, we know from 2 Samuel chapter 5 and verse 4 that he dies at the age of 70. King David dies at the age of 70. Within that verse, it tells us that he was 30 years old when he became king. And then he reigned over Israel for 40 years. So we add the two together, we know that he dies at the age of 70. At that point, then he leaves the construction project to Solomon, who God had instructed would be the one to build the actual temple. Four years or so after Solomon becomes king, he begins the construction of the temple. Solomon acquired more fine materials and skilled workers than David had provided for. David laid up all kinds of money and materials and such, and King Solomon even went beyond that and acquired even more workmanship and such of the highest quality. For its time, the temple was extremely impressive. King Solomon's temple was not designed to hold thousands of people. It wasn't a big football stadium, kind of a sanctuary like that. That wasn't the purpose of it. It was not the way it was designed, but it was instead to be a center of worship. The priests had carefully prescribed duties that were given to them by God, different rituals and things that they were to perform. Even the animal sacrifices we know were performed actually in front of the temple, not inside it. But nonetheless, it was a very impressive building. It didn't take long for the fame of Solomon and the temple that he constructed to become a symbol of godly worship among the Hebrew peoples, and also for its general fame to spread around that area of the Middle East. People knew about how grand and how beautiful Solomon's temple was. After Solomon's death, we know from 1 Kings chapter 12 that the kingdom was split. It was split into two separate kingdoms. The northern 10 tribes, including the tribes on the eastern side of the Jordan River, formed what we refer to as the northern kingdom. They were under the rulership of a man by the name of Jeroboam. The southern two tribes, comprising of both the tribe of Simeon and the tribe of Judah, made up what is called the southern kingdom, or the kingdom of Judah, under Rehoboam. By the year 721 BC, the kingdom of Israel was taken captive by Assyria. We've walked through this part of the history within our minor prophets study. 721 BC, the kingdom of Israel is taken captive by Assyria. Never to return home, these people would later migrate into Europe and eventually other parts of the world. We, within our modern day language, will sometimes refer to them as the lost 10 tribes, because generally speaking, people don't know where those 10 tribes have gone, where that northern kingdom has gone to. Mr. Armstrong, through God's inspiration, learned all of this. Some of you even came in, perhaps because of the U.S., Britain, and prophecy, and some of the information that Mr. Armstrong would teach decades and decades ago. Those 10 tribes are not lost. We know exactly where they are, but nonetheless, Assyria came in, took over that area, and moved those people on, moved them up into Europe, and again, they scattered to various parts of the world. Not learning the lessons of their northern brother, the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah, would, give or take a couple hundred years later, also go into captivity. The year 604 BC sees the first wave of Jews being taken into Babylon. The first group of Jews are taken into Babylon. And for the next 19 years, there's a series of battles between the Jews and the Babylonians. There's little scuffles, if you want to say it that way, that spring up. Zedekiah would be Judah's final king. He ends up forming an alliance with Egypt. Jeremiah speaks of this alliance and actually warns Zedekiah, the king, not to make the alliance. Zedekiah goes against Jeremiah's warning, makes the alliance anyway. That alliance ends up provoking Nebuchadnezzar, the king at the time of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar is very upset with it, very angry, sends his armies against the cities of Judah, and eventually sets up a siege around Jerusalem. A few years later, 587, the Babylonians break through Jerusalem's walls. Zedekiah ends up fleeing. He runs away, runs off to Jericho. The Babylonians follow, capture him, end up killing Zedekiah along with his sons. And you can read about those events in the book of Jeremiah, because again, he prophesies exactly what will happen. And through those prophecies, it's exactly what takes place. Zedekiah runs away to Jericho. He's caught, captured, and killed along with his sons. I want to drop a footnote here, because sometimes we refer to Israelites, we refer to Jews, we refer to people from Judah, people from, you know, God's people in different terms. Within this time period, we see Assyria taking over those northern 10 tribes. What is left are the Jews, what we would refer to as the Jews, that southern kingdom. That southern kingdom, as we'll see over the course of the next several minutes, have largely remained in that Middle Eastern area. They were not taken and dispersed like the northern 10 tribes were. So when we refer to the name Jews, we're typically referring to those who have previously made up this southern kingdom. These tribes of Judah and parts of Simeon. So I want to drop that important footnote there. We're not talking about all of Israelites in general. When we speak of those who are in that Jerusalem area throughout history, post-captivity, we're referring to those southern tribes, those southern two tribes. Let's go over to the book of Jeremiah. Let's turn to Jeremiah chapter 39. Solomon's temple would end up standing for nearly 350 years, is about, roughly, about what that temple stood and functioned as it was supposed to for some 350 years. At that time, the temple is plundered. Again, Babylon has set siege around Jerusalem. They end up breaking through the walls. They plunder it. They loot it. They set it ablaze. And we read of this here in Jeremiah chapter 39 and verse 8. The Chaldeans burned the king's house and the houses of the people with fire, broke down the walls of Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar, captain of the guard, carried away captives to Babylon, the remnant of the people, and so on. You can read more about Jerusalem's fall here in Jeremiah 39. But the temple is destroyed. It's broken down quite a bit. Plundered, and that along with parts of the city are set on fire by the Babylonians. Let's go forward to the book of Daniel. You know, sometimes we read various prophecies, we read about things within the Bible, and again, we try to pull it out and we try to set it to the side, almost like it's its own entity. Let's go to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2 has a very powerful dream here that Nebuchadnezzar has, a very important dream that Nebuchadnezzar has. He brings in his magicians and other individuals that he works closely with and tells them to give him his dream, tells them to interpret the dream, and of course no one's able to. Word gets back that this man, Daniel, is able to do it. So Daniel comes before the king. Notice chapter 2 and verse 17. Daniel here has revealed the dream. Daniel went into his house, made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning the secret, so that Daniel and his companions may not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Daniel knew that God knew the secrets of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And so these friends, they gather together, they make petition to God that God would reveal the secret. God answers, and he goes in verse 24 and tells the captain of the guard, I know the secret, stop killing all the wise men of Babylon. Dropping down to verse 31, he is appearing before King Nebuchadnezzar, and he reveals the dream. Verse 31 of Daniel chapter 2. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron and the clay and the bronze and the silver and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was an incredible dream. God not only makes known to Daniel the dream, but in the verses following, he gives King Nebuchadnezzar the interpretation of the dream. The gold head is likened to Babylon. Gold is not necessarily the hardest metal, but it's very beautiful, very shiny, very precious. The silver chest is likened to Persia, who would be the next world ruling empire. The brass stomach and thighs likened to Macedonia under the command of Alexander the Great, the Greeks. The iron legs would be the beast with the various horns. These are the 10 revivals of the Roman Empire. The iron and clay feet and toes as well. Daniel outlines what the next many hundreds of years will look like from the perspective of world ruling empires. And so this prophecy is important because even what we're studying within the minor prophets fits in here. We see Assyria come out and they end up conquering the kingdom of Israel, that northern kingdom. They take them into captivity. The Babylonians come along. They take captive the kingdom of Judah, that southern kingdom. But we also know that Babylon would eventually fall. And this prophecy makes note of all those successive empires that would rule. Bible prophecy is revealed by God. And I believe very strongly that Bible prophecy allows us to, sort of gives us a proof that God is, that He is all-powerful, that He is all-knowing, and that He can set forth a prophecy like this. We can look back at it 2,000 years later and see exactly how these nations rose and fell. So that brings us to the second part of the sermon. This is the second temple. In 539 BC, as the Babylonians drank and partied on one particular night, Cyrus the Great quietly diverted the river Euphrates into irrigation canals. As the riverbed dried later on that evening, Cyrus marched his army during the early morning hours right into the heart of Babylon and swarmed the city. That particular battle only lasted a few hours. We can read about that in Daniel chapter 5. We see the feast here that Belshazzar is having. There's the mysterious handwriting on the wall that occurs. But notice verse 30. This is Daniel chapter 5 and verse 30. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. So Babylon falls. Verse 31, Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So you think oftentimes that battles rage on for months and years, and you know, some of these empires, it's a long, drawn-out battle. It's interesting to note here in Daniel chapter 5, verse 30, that this transition between the Babylonian Empire and the Persian Empire took only a few hours, took one night. And again, this is some of the beauty that's contained within the Bible. We can look back in history and see what Cyrus did. We can see how Cyrus was able to march his army right into the heart of Babylon and take out that city just within a few hours. The Persians now dominated that region of the world. And as part of their booty, if you want to say it that way, as part of their taking over the Babylonian empire, was that they also received the Jewish captives. Remember the Jews, that southern kingdom was taken captive by Babylon. And so when the Persians took over, part of what they got was all of these captives. So they received back all of the Jewish captives from that southern kingdom. Now here's a very important point to consider. Remember that Babylon took the kingdom of Israel captive and took them, and they ended up scattering across Europe and other parts of the world. The Persian policy concerning captives was very different than Babylon. So Babylon had a policy that when they went into an area and they took people captive, they would take those people out of their homeland and disperse them into other areas. The Persian policy was very different. The Persian policy was that they would go in and conquer an area and they would leave the native people there. And so when Persia takes over from Babylon, they're left with a large number of Jewish captives. According to Persian policy, those Jewish captives had to go back home. And so that's why when we get to books like Ezra and Nehemiah and even parts of Jeremiah and Haggai, what we've been studying, that's why there's this edict for them to go back and rebuild their city. It was part of the Persian policy. Very different than the Babylonian policy. The Babylonians would conquer and take the people away. The Persian policy said, we'll conquer a people and we'll leave them there, or we'll send them back to where they came from. And so in 538 BC, Cyrus issues a decree permitting the Jewish captives from his empire to return back to Judea. That's why that took place. It wasn't just because Cyrus was having a good day and he decided, hey, let's send the Jews back. Let's let them rebuild. It wasn't just Cyrus being a good guy. That was the empire's policy. And so he was simply following through on the policy, the established and approved policy of the empire. Well, let's turn to Ezra chapter 1. Ezra chapter 1, we'll read this very briefly here. Ezra chapter 1 and verse 1, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in a writing saying, and you can read verse 2 on your own later this week, he sends them back. Is God involved in that? Absolutely God's involved in that. I often wonder why the Persians had that policy. And I wonder if God didn't put that policy in someone's mind back when they were still trying to form their empire and trying to figure things out about how they would rule. Zerubbabel and Joshua, the high priest, end up clearing off the rubble off the Temple Mount. If you go over to Ezra chapter 3, we can get a hint at this. The people are coming back. Some of the Jewish captives are returning. Again, not the Israelites from that northern kingdom. They've been moved on. Now, this is going to be largely the people from that southern kingdom, from the kingdom of Judah, that are coming back into Jerusalem. They're clearing off the rubble. They're clearing off that Temple Mount site. Chapter 3 of Ezra, in verse 1, when the seventh month had come and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered together as one man to Jerusalem. And Joshua, the son of Jozadak, and his brothers, the priests, Zerubbabel, these gentlemen arose and built the altar of God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. Though fear had come upon them because the people of those countries, they set on the altar on its base, they offer burnt offerings on it to the Lord, both the morning and evening burnt offerings. Remember from the Feast of Pentecost this last Sunday, my sermon which touched on the burnt offerings. This was a Thanksgiving offering. It was a free will offering from that perspective. At this time, it's important to note that it was not considered required to have a temple in order to have sacrifices. And so we see the people coming back over the course of these early chapters of Ezra, and the temple hasn't been rebuilt, but they clear off the space and they set up the altar and they immediately start making sacrifices. Now, this is an important point to remember. We'll come back to this toward the end of the sermon with what's going on today over in modern day Israel. But at this time, they did not feel it was necessarily one dependent on the other. You didn't have to have the temple in order to offer sacrifices. The project we know from our study this month in Haggai experiences delays for more than a decade and a half or more, partly due to Cyrus being forced to kill off what's believed to be rising challengers to the throne, but also individuals like Sanballat in the book of Nehemiah, who rises up and is sort of this thorn in the Jews' flesh. He's sort of this antagonistic individual. He's believed to be a Samaritan, and the Samaritans were very much in the face of the Jews, trying to frustrate them, trying to help them, or trying to slow them down. Darius the Mede ends up ascending to the throne somewhere around 522 B.C., In 515, the main edifice is complete and dedicated. That is the main building of the temple, not the whole area, but the main edifice is completed. 515 BC, they go through a dedication ceremony and dedicate the temple. That second temple was similar in size to the one Solomon built, a little bit smaller, historians believe, but it was nowhere near the magnificent structure that was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. A little bit smaller, but nowhere near the grandeur. But because of the prophecies uttered by Daniel and Ezekiel, Haggai, Zechariah, many individuals begin to look for the Messiah, for that messianic kingdom to be set up. And they believe the second temple would play a very important role in that. However, years ticked by, time went on, and the Messiah never came. They felt that, in part, the description that Ezekiel would make in Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48, there is a very glorious temple that's described in tremendous detail there, not only size, but contents and building materials and such. People began to think that that would be the temple that would be rebuilt and that the Messiah would sort of inhabit. But the Messiah never came in their eyes. He never came. Soon enough, though, the Jewish people would become lax in their religious worship. They ended up intermarrying with some of the local people. Nehemiah, upon hearing the sad news, ends up gaining support and permission to go back and to help finish the construction effort, to help rebuild Jerusalem, to help rebuild some of the wall structure, which has now been long delayed. You can read about that in Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 1 through 8. He gains permission and goes back. Again, the main edifice is the temple has been completed and dedicated, but there's still a lot of work to do within the walls and within Jerusalem itself. In the year 457, the Persian king Artaxerxes issues a decree to officially restore and rebuild Jerusalem. You can read about that in Ezra chapter 7. But we have, again, just to back up a little bit, the temple is rebuilt, rededicated, but there's still a lot of work to be done on the wall in Jerusalem. Nehemiah goes back, and shortly thereafter, Artaxerxes makes this public decree that this city is to be rebuilt with its walls and its buildings and everything. It's to be fully rebuilt, Ezra chapter 7. From here, let's go over to the book of Daniel, because we see another very important prophecy that ties in with this part of the Jewish history. Daniel chapter 9. Breaking into a larger prophecy, I just want to look at one aspect of this prophecy. Let's look at Daniel chapter 9 and, again, breaking into the middle of it. Verse 25 is where I want to go. Daniel chapter 9, verse 25. Keep in mind where we are in history. Artaxerxes has just issued this decree. It's the year 457 BC, and there's this official decree to rebuild Jerusalem. Daniel chapter 9, verse 25. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The streets shall be built again and the wall, even in troublesome times. So without understanding context, as the Jews would not have had at that time either, they see this, they think, this is awesome. King Artaxerxes just issued this decree. In 69 weeks, the Messiah will return. Right? That's what the Jews think. There's great joy. There's celebration. They're on fire. 7 and 62 weeks later, there'd be a restoration, a fully rebuilding of Jerusalem, and here's the Messiah. Let's see how this ties in. We know from our perspective that this was not 69 literal weeks. We're in the year 457 BC. 69 weeks later, does not bring us to the time of Jesus Christ. Right? But this is really neat. 62, or the wheat within, let's do this. Hold your place here. Let's go back to Ezekiel chapter 4. Let's just tie in this reference. Ezekiel chapter 4. And we see what a prophetic wheat really is. Ezekiel chapter 4 and verse 6. When you have completed them, lie again on your right side, and you shall bear the iniquity of the house of Judah 40 days. I have laid on you a day for each year. Okay, so the prophecy that we read back in Daniel chapter 9 is not a literal 69 weeks. It's a prophetic 69 weeks. And if we take examples like Ezekiel chapter 4 and verse 6 that we read here, there are others that say similar things, and we take a day for a year principle, we don't have 69 literal weeks, but 69 prophetic weeks. 69 prophetic weeks. The amazing prophecy here, dated from Artaxerxes' decree again in the year 457, predict not only the rebuilding of Jerusalem, but also, to a T, it predicts the coming of the Messiah. So God reveals here in this prophetic symbol that a day equals a year in prophecy. Another verse you can write down is Numbers 14:34. It gives that day for a year principle as well, Numbers 14:34. So we take 69 literal weeks. Each week has 7 days. We multiply those together, and we get 483. 483 prophetic years. So this prophecy that we're reading here in Daniel chapter 9 and verse 25 talks about 483 prophetic years. Okay, Mr. Dowd, so what? Again, going back to Artaxerxes' decree, the temple has been largely rebuilt. It's been rededicated. Jerusalem still needs a lot of work. The walls still need a lot of work. Nehemiah petitions. He comes back. It's followed up very quickly with Artaxerxes' decree saying Jerusalem will be rebuilt. Year 457. If we take 457 BC and we add to it 483 years, we come to the year 27 AD. Okay, what's significant about the year 27 AD? Well, let's go over to the book of Luke. Luke chapter 3. We have Artaxerxes' decree in 457. We're adding to it 69 prophetic years, which is 483 years. And that brings us to the year 27 AD. Remember, there's a year there that you have to add into for the year zero, in case you're doing the math on your paper. So that brings us to the year 27 AD. Notice Luke chapter 3 and verse 21. When all the people were baptized, it came to pass that Jesus also was baptized. And while he prayed, the heaven was opened. The Holy Spirit descended in a bodily form like a dove upon him. A voice came from heaven which said, "You are my beloved Son, and you I am well pleased." What's the significance of the year 27 AD? That significance is this is when Jesus Christ's earthly ministry begins. This is when it begins. And so the prophecy in Daniel chapter 9 is profound. And we see even Jesus Christ's return being tied to what we're studying in the Minor Prophets. It's being tied back to Ezra and Nehemiah and some of Jeremiah's prophecies. It's being tied back to the temple being destroyed and Artaxerxes issuing this command to rebuild Jerusalem. It's not just a prophecy that's buried somewhere in Daniel. The prophecy points to the very year that the Messiah would begin his ministry, 27 AD. the Messiah had arrived. We know that most of the world would not accept him. He came to bring his Father's message, to bring his Father's gospel, to teach about proper respect for one another, loving our God, dying for our sins. And of course, 3.5 years later, after 3.5 years of active ministry, then he was put to death by Roman crucifixion. I think it's amazing how Bible prophecy ties into so many different aspects. It's not the Old Testament. It's not the New Testament. Don't pick your favorite. It's one book. And it's so tightly connected. After the reform period of Ezra, Nehemiah, Judea finds itself yet again witnessing the change of ruling empires. And again, remembering back with what we read earlier in Daniel chapter 2, we know the next empire to come on the scene. Persia falls to the Macedonian or the Greek ruler Alexander the Great. And Daniel chapter 8 and verse 6 describes this. After Alexander dies, moving forward in history, after Alexander dies, the empire is split. There's no definite world leader that's going to succeed Alexander the Great. And so his empire is literally carved up into four different areas. And he has four leading generals that each take over each of those areas. Daniel chapter 8 and verse 8 talks about that. Verse 6 talks about Alexander the Great. Two verses later in verse 8, Daniel 8, 8 talks about his four generals uprising. That horn is broken off. The goat's horn is broken off. Alexander dies. And Daniel 8, 8 says that there are four others that rise up in his place. These are his four generals that rise. Let's just turn back there real quick. We need to go back to Daniel anyway. Let's notice Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8 and verse 6. Then he came to the ram. This is the prophecy of the ram and the goat. He came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing by the river, and he ran at him with furious power. This is Alexander the Great running at the Persian Empire. You can study history books and you will quickly learn that Alexander conquered his territory in magnificent time. He was very quick. He was very fast. And so that Greek Empire was established very quickly. And so here in verse 6, we see that he runs at him with furious power. That goat runs at the ram. In verse 8, therefore the male goat grew very great. Alexander, his empire was a tremendous empire. When he became strong, the large horn was broken. He died. And in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. These are his four generals. His four generals come and take his place. Judah ends up lying within the path of two constantly warring factions. Of those four generals, two of them are more superior. Two of them are more powerful. And so Judea lays right in the path of these two most powerful generals. And so again, they see themselves in the midst of this war between two neighboring territories. The Ptolemies of Egypt and the Seleucids of Syria. Wars waged back and forth for nearly three centuries. In the year 175 BC, Assyrian, one of the Seleucids of Syria, his name was Antiochus Epiphanes. He became ruler of the Seleucids in Syria. A few years later, in the year 168, he attempted a military campaign to Egypt. Why would he go to Egypt? That's where the Ptolemies were. Remember, that's where one of the other generals was. That was the other most powerful general out of Alexander's army. He goes to Egypt to try to wage a military campaign. He's thwarted by soon rising Roman Empire. The Romans step in and stop it. But over the next year, Antiochus Epiphanes turns his wrath onto the Jews. He looks to Judea, and that's where he focuses his anger and his wrath. Jerusalem is later captured. A Syrian garrison was stationed near the Temple Mount, and several things happened at that point. The temple sacrifices were stopped. The observance of the seventh-day Sabbath was stopped. The feast days were outlawed, along with circumcision. Those four things occurred when Antiochus Epiphanes captured Jerusalem and stationed a military presence there. It was forbidden of all Jews to do any of these four things, and if anyone was caught practicing any of those four things, it was death. Let's go to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11 and verse 31. Daniel chapter 11, verse 31, and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. So we see, again, history tying in with Bible prophecy. Two months after Antiochus takes over Jerusalem, on the 25th of the Jewish calendar month of Kislev, in the year 167 BC, Antiochus sets up on the Temple Mount, he sets up an altar to the Greek god Zeus, and he offers swine, thus fulfilling Daniel chapter 11, in part, verse 31. As Daniel had prophesied, it was an abomination of desolation. The year 167 BC, Antiochus offers swine to the pagan god Zeus, right there on the Temple Mount. Now, the date is important. It's the 25th of the last month of, I believe it's the last month of the Jewish calendar, Kislev. It equates sort of to our November, December within the Roman calendar. That abomination was prophesied by Daniel to last 2,300 evenings and mornings. Well, let's go back to Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8, and notice verse 13. We have this abomination set up. Swine is altered on the Temple Mount to a false god. Daniel chapter 8 and verse 13. I heard a holy one speaking and another holy one saying, another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation? The giving of both the sanctuary and the host be trampled underfoot. This vile, profane thing has happened. Antiochus has come in. He set up this false center of worship at the Temple Mount. Pig is being offered on the altar to a pagan god. And verse 13 here of Daniel 8 essentially says, how long? How long is this going to go on? Verse 14, he said to me, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. If you have a margin in your Bible, it's likely that the word days there in your margin will say evenings and mornings. So these are not days like we think of them as from the perspective of 24-hour days. These are not 2,300 24-hour days. These are 2,300 evenings and mornings when those sacrifices would normally be offered. So it's prophesied to last 2,300 evening and morning sacrifices. Okay, that breaks down half of 2,300 is 1,150. Okay, so it's prophesied to last 1,150 days is how long this abomination of desolation was to continue. In other words, right about 3 years. 1,150 days until God would restore the sacrifices. That's the prophecy. these 3 years would be very difficult for the Jews. They were forced to eat pork, and they were forced to worship pagan gods, and those who refused to do either one were very mercilessly killed. In the Judean hills, however, at the same time, a band of zealous Jews, who would later become known as the Maccabees, would grow in numbers and in strength. Now, they were also referred to as the hammerers. Exactly 3 years to the day from the setting up of Zeus on the Temple Mount, the 25th of Kislev, this time in the year 164, 3 years later, the Maccabees liberated Jerusalem. The Maccabees tore down the pagan gods from the Temple Mount, and they restored proper worship. As a footnote, if you have any Jewish friends that celebrate the festival of Hanukkah, it's that festival that commemorates this particular instance. The festival of Hanukkah, or the festival of lights, recalls the cleansing of the temple during these days of the Maccabees, when this 1,150 days, this 2,300 evenings and mornings, at the conclusion of that, the Maccabees liberated Jerusalem, restored everything pure and good to the Temple Mount. It's the festival of Hanukkah that celebrates and commemorates that particular time in Jewish history. By 63 BC, the Roman general Pompey marches his army into Jerusalem. So we're 100 years later or so, the Romans are now in charge, and Pompey marches into Jerusalem. He hurls huge boulders into the city and at the temple. And through this process, he's able to partially damage both the city and the temple. And so Jerusalem once again falls to foreign occupation and military. So this brings us on to the third part of the sermon, the third temple. There was an Edomite at the time who was loyal to Rome. His name was Herod. There are a lot of Herods. His name was Herod. He was appointed king of Judea in the year 37 BC. He was a cruel taskmaster, but he also loved building projects, and he was very good at them. He was very good at designing them and overseeing them. He mastered the art of creating show places, and he did so on a very grand scale. Due to the great unrest within the Judea area at the time, Herod attempted to settle the Jews by deciding to rebuild and sort of remodel and upgrade the temple and make it yet another one of his masterpieces within the Roman Empire. Part of Herod's logic was that Cyrus and Darius, remember back in the Persian Empire, where Ezra came out of, and Haggai and those guys with Zerubbabel's temple, Herod cited that those Persian leaders changed what was considered the proper measure. And so, according to him, their temple, their version of the temple, was built to the wrong scale. And so this was part of Herod's argument for building this ginormous temple area. Now, he claimed that the Persians allowed it to be built incorrectly. And he also cited what we studied this month in Haggai, that it was not to the same glory and grandeur as Solomon's temple was. And so these were some of the things that Herod cited to try to, in some ways, try to calm the Jews. Hey, I'm going to rebuild it. I'm going to rebuild it to the proper measurements. I'm going to build it with grandeur like Solomon's temple was. We're going to build it to the right scale. And as a side note, hopefully that will calm you Jews. It was in this temple that Jesus would later throw out the money changers. We can read about that in Matthew chapter 21. Matthew chapter 21. And in verse 12, Jesus went into the temple of God. This is the temple here that Herod rebuilt slash remodeled slash upgraded, however you want to say it. Jesus went into that temple that Herod built and drove out all those who bought and sold in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves and various animals. Oh, your animal isn't good enough for sacrifice. It has a little blemish here, buy one of ours. That was some of the extortion that went on in the day. So is this temple that Jesus would end up teaching from, that he instructed his disciples in, that he would make the point about the widow's mite when she came with her offering, instances such as what we read here in Matthew 21, verse 12, about the cleansing of the temple and the throwing out of the money changers and such. This is the temple that Herod sort of remodeled, you might say. It was a magnificent building project, and by many accounts, a very beautiful structure. However, it was done in Herod's honor and for his own personal glory and sort of feather in his cap. After Christ's death, we come forward a number of years to the year 66 AD, the Jews revolt against Rome. 66 AD, the Jews revolt against Rome. Over the next 3 years, Rome would end up bringing this rebellion under control. In the year 69 AD, the siege brought famine to Jerusalem. The Roman army had encircled Jerusalem. They cut off supplies, and there was a famine within Jerusalem. Jerusalem's population had swollen by the thousands as refugees from around the area went to the only safe place they knew. There's an estimated 25,000 Jewish fighters that were preparing to stand off against some 80,000 Roman soldiers. By AD 70, the following year, General Titus attacks Jerusalem, and within 3 weeks, Jerusalem has fallen, and Titus had broken through. In late 70 AD, the Temple Mount falls to the Roman military. There's some speculation as far as the fire. You might recall that there was a fire set to Jerusalem and to the temple during this particular battle. Some claim Titus set the fire. Others claim it was never Titus's intent to burn it. Some will say that it was one of his soldiers that took a piece of burning wood and threw it into the temple that caught it on fire. Whichever version of the story you prefer, it doesn't change the fact that the temple burned. It was brought to flame and burned. Within days, the temple was in ruin and most of Jerusalem was destroyed. Let's go over to the book of Mark. Mark chapter 3. Again, there's an interesting correlation here to history. I'm sorry, Mark 13. Mark 13. Again, here's another prophecy by Jesus that would later be fulfilled here within the late months of AD 70. Mark chapter 13, verse 1, as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here. Aren't these structures beautiful, teacher? Look at how great and how beautiful these things are. Aren't they just awesome structures?" Verse 2, Jesus answered and said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." Okay, we read that and we sort of move on. But again, let's connect this back with history. Fast forward again to AD 70. The temple is on fire. 3 days later, the place is in ruin. Sections of the temple had been overlaid with gold. And as we know, what happens with gold in tremendous heat, they begin to melt. Once it cools, it solidifies again. It's believed that soldiers and looters pushed stones aside in order to gather up the precious metals that were now available within this temple structure. to the point that sometimes they'd have to move stones in order to get to something precious underneath that stone. I think it's an interesting piece of history that ties directly in here with Mark chapter 13 verses 1 and 2. Literally no stone was left as the looters and soldiers came through searching for those precious and worthy materials, those metals. They would continue to toss whatever stone still laid in its original place. And so to date, no Jewish temple has to this day ever been built again on Mount Moriah, that original piece of property that we know that David bought back where we started this message. Fast forwarding to our modern day, 1948 obviously saw the Jewish state being declared a nation. A few years later, 1967 was called what is referred to as the Six-Day War. At the conclusion of that war, Israel occupied all of Jerusalem, the West Bank, as well as the Golan Heights. But speculation since then has continued on as to whether and how and when the Jews would again worship there on the Temple Mount, when they would be able to offer animal sacrifices, and when they'd be able to build a temple. The Jewish High Court in the year 1983, some of you may remember this ruling, 1983 decided that the Temple Mount was indeed a holy site for the Jews. They also declared that the Jews have access to that holy site on the Temple Mount. However, the political situation in Jerusalem is so delicate that no one has attempted as of yet to put that ruling into place and to take action on that ruling. I want you to go back to the days of Zerubbabel and the temple that was restored under his governorship. You'll remember that a sacrificial altar could be set up even if there was no temple. And I wonder if that might play in at some point in our future, where the Jews at one day will set up some sort of altar, despite whether or not the temple is there. There's some evidence to support that the Holy of Holies is some 100 yards north of the current Dome of the Rock that's considered by the Muslims to be their holy site. I suppose it's possible that if political situations could be worked out 100 yards to the north of the Dome of the Rock, if that's where the Jews believe the Holy of Holies is, that some sort of sacrificial altar could be set up there. There's been discussion in recent years also about a red heifer. Some believe that there's a portable altar that's already being hidden somewhere, that red heifer has been born and is in sort of a heifer protection program by the Jews so that no one can see it or kill it or harm it in some way. Maybe you are aware of other theories or stories, news articles that you've read. Some probably true, some probably not true. There is no doubt, though, that some of the prophecies that looked forward from the Babylonian captivity were fulfilled, at least in type, during the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. Other prophecies we know about the temple will not be fulfilled until God's kingdom is fully established. But many prophecies pertain to events that will soon take place in Central Europe and in the Middle East before the coming of the end of this age. Let's always remember that events brought about by people are not necessary there to fulfill prophecy. It is God who inspires the fulfillment of those events that he prophesies. We can all look forward to the soon establishment of God's peaceful government on this earth. Let's move to the fourth part. It's a very short part, the fourth temple, if you want to refer to it that way. I'd like to go back to the book of Ezekiel, chapter 40. Ezekiel chapter 40. This is a very interesting read if you'd like to at some point read through chapters 40 through 48. This describes what we will sometimes refer to as the Ezekiel temple or Ezekiel's temple. Notice Ezekiel 40, beginning in verse 1. In the 25th year of our captivity, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th day of the month, and the 14th year after the city was captured, on the very same day, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he took me there. In the visions of God, he took me into the land of Israel and set me on a very high mountain. On it toward the south was something like the structure of a city. He took me there, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of bronze. He had a line of flax and a measuring rod in his hand, and he stood in the gateway. And he said to me, Son of man, look with your eyes and hear with your ears and fix your mind on everything I show you. For you were brought here so that I might show them to you. Declare to the house of Israel everything you see. And the next chapters all the way through chapter 8 describe here what Ezekiel, through this vision, was able to see. Let's skip forward to chapter 43. Ezekiel 43, verse 1. The middle chapters is a lot of measuring, taking him into different parts of the temple and measuring and notating different things. Chapter 43, verse 1. Afterward, he brought me to the gate that faces toward the east. And behold, the glory of God of Israel came from the way of the east. His voice was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory. It was like the appearance of the vision which I saw, like the vision which I saw when I came to destroy the city. The visions were like the visions which I saw by the river of Chebar, and I fell on my face. Verse 6. Then I heard him speaking to me from the temple while a man stood beside me, and he said to me, Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet where I dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever. No more shall the house of Israel defile my holy name, they nor their kings by their harlotry or with the carcasses of their kings on their high on the high places, when they set their threshold by my threshold and their doorpost by my doorpost, with a wall between them and me, they defile my holy name by the abominations which they committed. Therefore I have consumed them in my anger. Now let them put their harlotry and the carcasses of their kings far away from me, and I will dwell in their midst forever. It's a very beautiful prophecy of a king, of a throne yet to be witnessed here on this earth. The temples of Zerubbabel and Herod were not built with the same splendor, glory, and accuracy with which Solomon's temple was built. And even within Solomon's temple, there's some that say that his courts were not exactly the way they should be. At any rate, they were God's temples. And you and I today, as individual temples building up to the larger temple, as we talked in the Bible study, these are God's temples. They were God's house. However, they don't measure up to the plan that God gave David, nor this beautiful plan here in Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48. It's highly likely that the next temple we see will be this ultimate temple, this ultimate beautiful house of God himself. Let's go for our final verse over to the book of Ephesians, chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2, let's notice verse 19. Now, therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being fitted together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. You and I are in the building phase of our callings. God has called each of us, and He's given us a building to build. He's given us a life to live, a godly life to seek after. And He wants to be able to dwell there through His Spirit, verse 22. The key, though, for us to consider is, as we have seen in the book of Haggai, God is working individually and collectively with us. Your body is a living temple to our God. We should keep it clean. We should keep it holy. And we should keep it unspotted from the world. Brother, this has just been a little recap of world history as it relates to certain Bible prophecies. These temples that God has used down through time are not standalone buildings. They were very powerful for what God was doing in and through the people that He worked with, and even for us today. I'll put the handouts on the back table. I hope that you will find them helpful in your continued studies with Haggai and the overall magnificent, inspired book of God.